You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening. I'm Arye Nair. I'm president of the Open Society Institute, and I'm very glad to welcome you here this evening for a discussion of Viktor Oshotinsky's book, Human Rights and Their Limits. Viktor Oshotinsky is my colleague in the Open Society Institute. He serves as a member of the International Advisory Board of the Open Society Institute, and he has various other positions within OSI, which I won't go into. He also is a professor at the Central European University, based in Budapest, and teaches in the Legal Studies program at the Central European University. He has also had affiliations with a variety of law schools, the University of Warsaw, Chicago. No?
Never. Okay. No, I was kicked out in '68 and never asked after that to come back.
Okay, the University of Chicago Law School.
Okay. That's Warsaw too. You know.
Okay, and the University of Connecticut. And he's written quite a number of other books. Richard Wilson, who will take part in the discussion this evening, was trained as an anthropologist and has served as director of the Human Rights Institute at the University of Connecticut for the past 8 years. And we're going to begin by asking Viktor to talk a little bit about the book. And then I'm going to ask Rick Wilson to make some comments, and then I'm going to initiate a discussion and perhaps raise some questions focusing on issues where I may have some doubts about the points of view expressed by Viktor.
Fabulous.
Okay.
So thank you, Arye. I just want to say at the beginning that this book in great deal combines my life experience at my research. It was, most of it was written at 4 or 5 times of my visits at the Human Rights Institute at the University of Connecticut. I want to acknowledge Gary Gladstein, who funded this institute to a great deal, and also my professorship over there, and I'm grateful for this. I wrote this book primarily to put in order this combination of my curiosity and life experiences with research that I was doing and teaching that I've been doing for almost 20 years. And I just want to say about life experience. In 1968, I was a young assistant at the law school. That was the only time I was there at the University of Warsaw. And we had some purges and the demonstrations at that time. We went to the streets or to the university campus and demonstrated for freedom of expression, freedom of speech, all these other freedoms. And at that time, we never used the notion of human rights. It was 1968. We were trying to justify our protest in the terms of communist government violating its own communist constitution of 1952. And then in 1976, we had some other workers' riots this time in Poland, and at that time, human rights were already used as the justification. And in 1980, at Solidarity period and 1981, human rights was basically the crucial justification for the protest and the legitimization of the protest. So something happened between 1968 and 1976, 1980, which was first of all that human rights became legitimate issues with the ratification of the signing first and ratification of the Human Rights Pact, and also the return and emergence of human rights, international human rights movement, at something that was justifying claims to freedom and better life that did not happen before. And I remember around that time I was interested to study the issue of human rights, and I thought that if I go to the West and to get to the library or bookstore, I will find a lot of books about what human rights are, what they are not, about history of human rights. And to my dismay, I didn't find many. I found a lot of articles or books specific about some human rights issue, but I did not find some. I wanted to have like fundamental primer about human rights. In the 1980s, I couldn't find that. I could not find much about history, and I started my own research. But with time, this research was combined with my involvement with Open Society Institute in various human rights projects and programs. And I write in the introduction to my book about 6 or 7 very important experiences in my life and in that involvement, in which I started to think differently, or some new area of research was opened to me by my practical involvement, or something that I did not see before. And as I said in my acknowledgement to my colleagues from Open Society Board, Justice Initiative Board, Human Rights Governance Grant Program, I hope that reading this book you will realize how much you contributed to this book by experience, by finding common things that never came to my mind, like about the importance of inclusion and citizenship issues that I encountered first time with OSI, or even about a year or so ago, I had a very skeptical attitude towards the so-called right to development, until I found that the Open Society Justice Initiative is preparing cases about the pillage of natural resources, which are based on the concept of the right to development, and that was also extremely important for me. I could see in 1990s, 1980s, human rights really growing in importance, and at the same time I could see also it sense some places and somewhere not abuse but overuse of human rights. People started more with human rights becoming something acknowledged and good money, you know, to use. People started to use that money for many transactions to which this money, I believe, do not belong. And that's why I was also interested with the limits of human rights. And basically, where do they belong, where they don't? And that's what the book came out to be about. It has a historical chapter. Initially, it was the second chapter, but I owe that to Richard Wilson and Andrzej Rapaczynski, who couldn't come today, in their reviews of the book, that I changed completely the structure, redo the historical chapter, and started book with that. And then I deal with 4 basic issues: the relationship between human rights and democracy, claiming basically that excess of the democracy is indispensable for rights, and rights are indispensable for democracy. However, the excess of rights is, in a sense, impoverishing democracy and political process, and vice versa, the excess of democracy can be very dangerous to rights. In the next chapter, I deal with rights and needs and social and economic rights issue, which is very much debated and discussed, and I also try to reach some compromise by saying that actually I prefer to talk about social and economic needs, some of which in some situations can be to some of which the rights can be applied, and I also come up with some specific issues that differ in my understanding social and economic rights from civil political rights. And these are 2 basically. The first, that they originated from a sense of obligation of the ruler or community to the individual, rather than as rights and they were claimed that way, and that leads me to the understanding that these rights can be made conditional, that even when they are rights, they can be made conditional upon some contribution to the society by the recipient of such rights, while civil liberties and political rights so are absolutely unconditional. But I make it much more defined in that chapter. Then I deal with the issue of universality of rights in the chapter of rights and culture, and I distinguish between hard and soft universalists, and I support something that I call soft universalist, which is not imposing the philosophy of rights or even rights, definitely philosophy, on others, but rather sharing the experience and considering rights as self-limitation. And to me, perhaps the most important from my perspective was the last thing, which deals with human rights and other values, human rights and ethics, human rights and the search for meaning, human rights and happiness. And I say that to these issues, the rights are pretty limited, of limited use. They are still indispensable for us to be responsible. We have to have freedom to be responsible and to act as responsible people. But basically, if we search for meaning or for happiness, we ourselves limit these choices and limit the rights. And this became to me pretty so important that I ended the entire book with the letter to a student that deals basically with these issues. Overall, I think that this was, for me, a long trip, very long. It was definitely the most difficult of over 20 books that I wrote, and perhaps one of the most satisfactory to me, but I don't know. I would just now shut up and listen if it is as satisfactory to others. Thank you.
Okay. Rick Wilson?
Thanks. I'm going to start with talking about the title of the book and the idea of limits. It just dawned on me as you were speaking at the end there about human rights, the end of your book, and human rights and ethics, human rights and intimacy. You could also have called the book Human Rights and Why They Can't Buy You Love, because it does very much end on how so many of the most important things in life actually human rights don't help you with. What's the value? I guess the question we could start with is, what is the value of understanding the limits of human rights? If human rights are a good thing, which we agree they are, can't we just keep expanding their purview and their mandate, transforming each new area to the benefit of all? Putting limits on human rights, isn't that the voice of defeat and pessimism? I would argue, so I think Victor argues, no. Victor's is very much the voice of a human rights moderate. Connecticut is sometimes referred to as the land of steady habits, which is a polite way of saying it can be boring as hell. But Victor wrote this book out in the wilds of stores, surrounded, always in October, over a 10-year period, surrounded by fall foliage. In fact, I remember you calling me a few years ago saying, Richard, I'm in love. And I said, wonderful, Victor. Eva isn't here yet. She arrives next week. And he said, I'm in love with the nature here. And you describe being very inspired to write in that environment. But I think there's partly your character, but there's certainly an environmental attribute to this as well. You're clearly aware of the value of human rights, but very cautious about overextending them. And you point out that history is full of big ideas, some of them very good ones, seemingly at the time, but that they've been discarded. And I think Victor's book does make human rights more flexible in the beginning of the 21st century and better prepared for the new challenges that lie ahead. In an international setting where there's an emphasis on the interdependence and indivisibility of rights, how rights always come together very nicely with each other, there's a neglect sometimes of a full understanding of the tensions. And I place Victor's thinking within a kind of earlier tradition of liberalism. You only cite Berlin once, but Isaiah Berlin's sense of we must make difficult decisions, that good things are in tension, and that human rights are not always synonymous with democracy struck me as very much in that earlier, perhaps post-war liberal tradition. And you remind us that populism and majority rule can threaten human rights, particularly with regard to immigrants and minorities, and also, on the other hand, that excessive constitutionalizing of rights can impoverish democracy, and that you can't always place the important debates about resource allocation or anything important in a society within, in a sense, kick them out of touch, as you would say, to use a rugby metaphor. Now it's in the Olympics. I can use this in front of you. Kick it out of touch and place it outside of the usual boundaries of democratic deliberation. This tension seems to be irresolvable, and we must accept it. And I think that's an important insight of the book. Perhaps more positively, Victor tells us that human rights are trumps. He understands them as primarily moral, in a moral sense. Although they can be legalized, they don't have a primarily legal basis. So he sees them as universally moral rights of a fundamental character, and this combines with his soft universalism. He uses the idea of dignity, as understood by Kant and Jacques Maritain, to do the work around linking dignity with rights, and I see that as very useful. You're cautious against human rights inflation, and you refer to a couple of areas, perhaps international relief and humanitarianism and environmental rights, where there's been this inflation of rights. But yet you're also willing to explore new and emergent areas of human rights, for instance, the horizontal application of rights, without the heady lack of abandon that one often finds in this field. And I have a couple of questions for you to see. I mean, these are areas that maybe I didn't fully understand. I mean, I agree with so many things in the book that it's very difficult to find elements that I disagree with. I think there were one or two gaps. One of the gaps is international justice. There's not really a discussion of the ICTY, the ICTR, the International Criminal Court. And I think, having discussed this with you, I think I know why, but it seemed that you didn't want to hang your aspirations for human rights very much upon international justice institutions, and I don't know if that's, you can't put everything in a book, or if there's a deeper reasoning there. Another area that I wanted to ask you about was social and economic rights. In this chapter, you acknowledge, and you're very aware of the criticisms of socioeconomic rights. You talk through the constitutions that have sought around the world to place these rights within a Bill of Rights, and I wondered where you stood on this. And I think maybe when you discussed the Grootboom case in South Africa, the South African Constitutional Court, tell me if I'm wrong, in the discussion of the right to housing in South Africa, that you seem to be affirming the South African Constitutional Court's approach to this, that the court decided that it could not dictate policy to the legislature on housing, but that it could demand that the legislature deliver such a policy and have it reviewed according to its constitutionality. So my question there is, have I understood your reading of socioeconomic rights, that you don't think one can instantiate socioeconomic rights and then read them off very clearly from the Constitution to the legislation, but that instead they're in a kind of dynamic exchange where the constitutionalizing, in a sense, sets the parameters of the rules of the game and then leaves the rest up to the legislature. So then I would come back to your question of human rights as trumps, because it strikes me that while you say they're trumps, actually you really only mean some of them are trumps and others aren't. And so it strikes me that whilst having established the strong position that human rights are trumps at the beginning, you then, and maybe I've misconstrued or misunderstood, it's perfectly possible, that you seem to be edging back on that when it comes to socioeconomic rights and seeing them as much more conditional, as derogable under certain types of conditions. So then we really have three positions on human rights that one could take. Either all human rights are trumps, and if something is instantiated as a human right, it's instantiated in a fairly absolute way. Secondly, some are trumps and the rest are derogable. And how do you decide? Generally, within international law, the idea is that really only three rights are understood as non-derogable: torture, genocide, and slavery. And the rest can be derogated under certain conditions, which are specified or not. And then thirdly, the position that none are trumps, and that they all must be understood in a different way. So I guess I would ask you to, and this is far too much in that, I just want to ask you to clarify that if possible. The final point I'd like to make, if I haven't run on too long as it is, I just want to apologize. I have read this book three times now, so there are too many, there's too much in here to really throw out succinctly. But the final point is that I feel like part of the book was written during an era of globalization, which kind of came to an end last year. And it felt to me, and this is not your fault, because anyone would have reacted similarly. But in the section of your book, I'm thinking here around page 83 and onwards, you talk about nation states losing their power over economies, with the exception of the U.S. and China, that governments are unable to control the decisions affecting their economies, and you grant a great deal of power to multinationals with easy electronic transfers of capital, of relocating factories from Brazil to the Philippines to Thailand. But perhaps that was the result of an era which lasted roughly between 1985 and 2008. And do we need to think about it differently now? Nation states stand a little taller than they did this time last year, and really only they have had the ability to withstand the economic recession, catastrophe, whatever you want to call it. And perhaps during that era we acceded too much to multinational corporations and bought into, were too accepting of the advocates of globalization. And accepted too readily the idea that the state was easily transcended and its powers amounted to very little in terms of, for instance, environmental regulation, financial regulation, or regulation of wages and conditions in the workplace, just to give a few examples. So would you, if you were back in stores in October writing this book still, which may be a nightmare for you, but if you were writing it now, would it be...
2 weeks are left of October.
Would you rewrite that section?
Okay. Before you answer some of those questions, let me pick up at least on one of them and then come to others. But Rick Wilson referred to... your idea that certain rights are moral rights, and you distinguish between moral rights and legal rights. And I have the question as to whether it is useful to use the term rights in circumstances in which they are not legally enforceable. That is, how is something a right if you can't actually ensure that the right is respected? And do you worry that in using the term rights more broadly, that you are softening the whole idea of rights, that if some rights are conditional, if some rights are not legally enforceable, does that undermine the concept of rights? Shouldn't rights be concept that does take precedence over other considerations? And if there are circumstances in which you you see rights as being conditional, does that weaken the entire concept of rights?
Okay. Let me start with my amazement that you ask this question and you are not a lawyer and I have to answer it and I am a lawyer, so at least by instruction or education. And my answer would be very simple. If I use the word rights, just the word rights, then the thesis implied in question would be right. Yes, rights need to be enforceable, enforced. But when I use the word human rights, it's a different thing. That's the difference between rights, the word rights, and the word human rights. Human rights was historical invention, basically in modern sense of the 1930s and 1940s when they were developed. And the people who were creating the concept of human rights and declaration of human rights, actually the last thing that they thought at that time about was their enforceability in legal sense. It is a fabulous testimony of Fariduddin Hoveyda, who died last year, who was the secretary to the Iranian Declaration at the United Nations work about human rights. He said this has to do with this issues of universality and cultural specificity. And he says that basically most of the people from outside of Europe, they had problems with human rights. They liked them, they supported them because Americans wanted and the West wanted, and they thought that they will give them legitimacy for national liberation of the countries that were not that were colonialized at that time. But they thought that even if there are some differences with their cultural tradition, they will never be enforced, that it will be not enforceable. So if we talk about human rights when the term was coined in the 1940s.
No, but it was coined earlier. I mean, surely if we think of, the 18th century authors of the American Bill of Rights and the French Declaration of Rights, surely they were ahead of us. Or you can go back to the 17th century and the English Bill of Rights, or go back to the arguments of the religious dissenters of the 17th century who were arguing for their own rights. I mean, they had the idea that rights should be legally enforceable.
Yeah, but only Thomas Paine was using the word that we can vaguely translate into human rights. They were not using the term human rights.
They were using the rights of man.
Yeah,
the rights of mankind. Even the term human rights appears from time to time.
Yeah, but I think these were rights of white male property owners, and they were individual rights. I make very clear in historical chapter in the part that I did not get enough into details because I will need another 20 years. I distinguish between 18th century concept of individual rights. Here you have a right which is given to individual as distinct from medieval concept where rights are basically protecting community and rather than individuals. In the 18th century, they are located in the individual, and basically for authors of these constitutions, they should be enforceable. And I think that this is one of the basic differences between that concept and the return of rights 2 centuries later in 1940s in the notion of human rights that for some people that were prior to that process, like Mandelstam or Frangoulis in the 1920s, they wanted rights to be enforceable, to be enforced. But for the framers of the Universal Declaration, not so. And now I think that when rights came back in the 1970s in the process in which you were so wonderfully involved, of course, civil liberties and political rights for human rights movement, for international human rights against, were the aim of something that has to be enforced. For me, that I was a recipient of your efforts in communist Poland, I would think the following. The concept, the notion of human rights, of course, this was not enforceable or not enforced in communist Poland. It was very useful as a moral concept. As a concept, I think that one of perhaps important contributions in this book is a very little section that is entitled Between morality and law. And I believe that we, if we look at that, because concept of human rights, I claim, is basically moral, primarily moral. It has ultimate goal of becoming legal whenever it can be legalized, either by constitutionalization, legalization, or as Professor Meron wrote in his books, through the adjudication of the courts and the international human rights. So this is the thing that is a goal. But when you look at that, many new rights or rights applied to the groups that did not cherish these rights were first formulated as moral postulate that was given the name of human rights, then with the attempt to make it legal and to legalize them. And
Victor, you said that when you were first involved in 1968, you were trying to get compliance with the Polish constitution. And in fact, if you think of the rights movement in the Soviet bloc, that legalistic approach was very much characteristic of what took place. The human rights movement in the Soviet Union probably dates to 1965.
For Halidze, yes.
Well, no, well, before that even, before Halidze. I think that the opening of it was the prosecution of Sinyavsky and Daniel.
Yes.
And in, I think it was December 65, I think December 5, the first demonstration was held in Moscow about the Sinyavsky and Daniel prosecution. And they chose that day in Moscow because it was Constitution Day in the Soviet Union. And the argument of the demonstrators in Pushkin Square that evening was that Sinyavsky and Daniel should get a public trial, which was required by the Soviet Constitution. So from the beginning, even in the communist world, there was this legalistic approach to human rights. And one of the things about the Soviet Union is that the movement for rights was led by scientists, and yet the scientists were known as legalists. The scientists like Kovalyov and Orlov and Sakharov and Chalidze were all very much preoccupied with detail and evidence and the things which were important in science. And so they gravitated toward a legalistic approach. And the whole human rights movement in the Soviet bloc, in fact, evolved as a legalistic movement.
It may be convenient for you to think that way, but I would change one word. You say from the beginning of human rights movement it was legalistic, and I say at the beginning of human rights movement it was legalistic. And I tell you why I distinguish between from and at, because there is discontinuity. Because at the beginning, when there is no ratified human rights documents and human rights movement, people are really talking about constitutions, however useless they are. Now, when the human rights come back through ratification of the pact, second through the international human rights law, but getting human rights into international politics, which is political rather than legal, then through human rights, international human rights movement, basically the focus is not only on legal instrument. And for me, solidarity experience would be very important. Solidarity was political movement when no one talked about legal remedies.
No, I agree.
No one at all. But we were full of human rights. Human rights as the values was the legitimization and justification of our protest, our demands, which were basically political rather than legal. And the The follow-up on that was that even in post-communist country, it took quite a time for the elites really to get into legal culture and the legal approach, which disappeared when this notion came in. So I think it is. I still we had different experiences, perhaps, and that.
Can I get a word?
Yeah, sure.
could I mean, you can both be right.
Yeah, that's what I think.
And one could distinguish between human rights talk and human rights law, and it strikes me that distinction allows you both to be correct. There is a whole area of human rights as social movements. The moral nature of law. I just think back to in the 1990s in Britain, there was this judge, Judge Pickles, who was this old British magistrate, who would do things like send single mothers to jail for 3 years for stealing a can of baked beans. And this was a real case. And there was moral opprobrium, and there was a clear tabloid campaign. Judge Pickles was driven out. And it was decided that the kind of old hang'em and flog'em British style of judgeship, and in fact the whole structure of the judiciary, of which 96% were members of private public schools, of which there were only two or three, you know, that all changed. And it was a result of this genuine kind of transformation of moral values. And that strikes me, that's the way law changes. So there is that kind of domain of moral discourse, of which human rights overlaps. It can overlap into the legal sphere and be legalized. But I think if one were to take Arya's point to its logical conclusion, only the rights that are enshrined in law are human rights, and everything else is moral talk. But then one has no explanation for how things that weren't human rights yesterday are human rights today. And so there's no explanation of the transformation.
You have to realize that I'm not very enthusiastic about an expanding domain of human rights in which something which was a moral argument yesterday is transformed into a human right. My approach to rights is that it is only by keeping the sphere of human rights relatively limited, that it is in fact possible to argue strenuously and vociferously for human rights. I don't want to be diluted in my advocacy of human rights by thinking of them as nebulous. And it seems to me that when one is engaged in this expansive approach to human rights, that inevitably becomes the case. And your question to Victor as to whether rights do trump other concerns, my argument would be yes, they do. But I have to then circumscribe my concept of rights, because it is only those circumscribed rights that actually can trump other considerations. The right not to be tortured trumps any consideration on the other side. There is no circumstance in which someone could come along and justify torture from my standpoint. And what I fear is that if rights are treated nebulously, then the argument that urgent circumstances justify torture will actually prevail. And to me, it's very important to head off that kind of argument. And to do so, I have to have this limited approach to rights. Because Victor mentioned a right to development. I mean, this is the most nebulous concept of all. It's nebulous on the one hand. On the other hand, it could only be enforced if there were some global institution which were capable of taking resources from one place and providing them to another place. So it's only a vague notion. But if vague notions like that get confused with rights, then how well am I going to do in saying that the right to speak, the right to a fair trial, the right to torture, these are things which need to be defended as sacrosanct.
But there are many things still that people believe that they should be entitled or that should be respected. Even so, they are not enforced or they cannot be enforced. The first example, the one that are not enforced, actually in countries where you have the rights enshrined in constitutions and enforced, you don't, very seldom you use, even you have to use your notion of human rights. In this country, people talk about civil rights because these rights, these civil rights that were enshrined in constitution, and people didn't use all this hazy idea of human rights. But in the countries, that's why human rights was American export rather than used for internal instrument for internal use. But people are calling for human rights in Burma, in communist Poland, in other places, precisely because they are not enforced. And that is the case. The second, I do believe that most of the debates about what is human rights and what is not is basically the debate about their means of enforcement. If you insist, as Cranston does or others, that all rights should be enforceable, then by definition you will have very limited, narrow definition or list of rights. If you believe that rights can be enforceable in different ways, let's say by constitution and by statutes, as is my position on social and economic rights, or by moral means or some means of the appeal to the conscience of humanity, etc., you can have much wider catalog of rights which are still rights and people are entitled to, but not in the identical way. And I believe in differentiated. For me, for example, the most basic human rights, absolutely most basic, is the one you will probably really be surprised or with that or outraged what I will say, but I will say nevertheless. Absolutely fundamental human rights for human being is a right of a child to be loved, of a child, only of a child. And adult people doesn't have such a right, but a child has. The adult people has to give love if he wants to be or she wants to be loved. But a child has, and this will forever become be moral right. But I will still advertise, and wherever I go, I will talk about this right, because I think this is so fundamental for human dignity.
Victor, I won't disappoint you. I do very much disagree with you.
Yeah, no, of course.
My own view of rights is that rights are limits on power. Is necessary to circumscribe the power of the state or of those who exercise state power or to whom state power has been delegated in some way. And that approach of limits on power seems to me to leave out a great many of the desirable things in the world, and the fact that something is important or desirable doesn't mean that I can put it into the category of rights. I think it's sometimes felt by those who champion an expansive notion of human rights that it denigrates their cause if you don't refer to something as a right. I have no interest in denigrating the significance of those things. I think they simply should be differentiated from rights. Something can be immensely important. The child's need for love can be of immense significance, but I don't think it's useful to call it a right. What does the child do? Does the child then go to some arbiter, some judicial body, and say, this right has been denied to me? It isn't something that is conceivable. I think it's useful to limit rights to those things that can be protected by placing limits on the exercise of state power.
On a historical note, I mean, I think that's a perfectly respectable position, but just as a historical reflection.
I'm glad it's not disrespectful.
He's not going to change anyway. But there's a great piece in Victor's book where he talks about Charles Epps' article, The Rights Revolution, which is a great, you know, discussion of these issues in the United States. And what Epps notes is that the entire thrust of progressive left-of-center politics in the United States since the 1960s has been about the enshrining of rights, from civil rights, disability rights, children's rights, environmental rights. It's been taking elements of progressive politics and seeking to, in some way, shape, or other, have a good Supreme Court decision on it in one's favor. And you could see that recently, perhaps the culmination in the Obama-McCain debate at the end of last year on universal health care, where you see the very polarized positions. And Obama says, I see health care as a right. And McCain says, I see it as a privilege. And there's two stark kinds of distinctions there.
And I would see it as a desirable policy.
Right. And so your argument is that democratic deliberation on the allocation of resources should take place within the democratic process.
Let me give you a real-world example that you know, I happen to be close to at this moment. The Open Society Institute has a foundation in Haiti, as impoverished a country as you could imagine, a country with every kind of need. And it happens that the woman who served from the time we established the foundation in 1995 as the executive director of the foundation, not long ago became the prime minister of Haiti. She left the post at the foundation. And so we've been talking to her about how we can be helpful to her as prime minister of Haiti. And she says that she considers the most urgent need in the country to be to reverse the problem of environmental degradation. She says that last year Haiti was struck over and over again by hurricanes, that because the mountains had been denuded of their forest cover because the trees were cut down over generations for use as charcoal for cooking purposes. When the hurricane struck, there were massive landslides, and schools, clinics, houses were all buried by these landslides. Large numbers of people were killed. She's got to do something about this problem of environmental degradation. They're dealing with education, dealing with health, are crucial issues in Haiti, but she can't address those unless she addresses the problem of the country's great vulnerability to the storms of the Caribbean. And part of her solution is to make it more valuable for Haitians to have trees in the ground than cut down, which means that the mountains have to be planted with fruit trees, mango trees, for example. Export businesses have to be created to export the mangoes. There have to be storage facilities, refrigeration, transport capacity in order to make this solution work. So there's going to have to be a certain amount of capital investment to create the infrastructure to deal with this problem of environmental degradation. And she has to put to aside other concerns because of the limited resources of the country. Now, you take an expansive definition of rights and you say, I have a right to education, I have a right to health, I have a right to Social Security. And you come to the Haitian government, which has these very limited resources, and you say, give me my right to education, give me my right to health care. And she says, no, I can't do that because I've got to solve this problem as a step towards solving those other problems. Is it useful in those circumstances to trump the democratic process with a rights approach? Or should the democratic process work? Should she have to go to the Haitian parliament and persuade the Haitian parliament through the political process that her solution is the right one? Maybe it's not. Maybe a different solution is possible. But the political process, setting public policies, seems to me the way in which one has to address the urgent needs of that country. And superimposing a rights process on something like that would be extremely destructive. Now, I don't want to see rights invoked in those circumstances. I want to see the democratic process, the political process, work to try to address the urgent needs of the country. On the other hand, if she were to propose, let's say, to torture somebody to stop them from cutting down trees on the mountainside, I would say, no, you can't do that. Or if somebody wanted to speak out against her plan and she tried to suppress that person, I would say, no, you can't do that. Or if she tried to put somebody in prison arbitrarily for opposing the plan, I would say, no, you can't do that. So rights are the place where you say no to those who have authority, to those who have power. But rights shouldn't be the mechanism where you trump public policy decisions that may not be something that you can frame in the International Covenant of Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights.
Arye, basically you wrote my book right now in much better way, probably, because that's what I'm writing in it. There is only one difference between
us.
The one difference is that what you are calling rights now, I call constitutional rights. And I believe, probably as distinct from you, that there is also possible use of the word rights, which for the rights that are not constitutional. Some of them are statutory, some of them are moral and will remain moral. And I find arguments why is it useful, because in that way, things that are not considered and acknowledged as rights today can become rights in your sense or better protected rights tomorrow. But I agree, whatever you say, there is a word for it. These are constitutional rights. And my answer to your question, yes, only constitutional rights are trumps. Only constitutional rights are trumps to politics. Politics is very important, and there are many rights which are a result of politics, which are statutory rights. If you have a politics and political process that decides about allocation of resources, about the social welfare, etc., as a result of that, people are endowed with statutory rights. They can claim these benefits. The difference is that political process can change these rights in the future, can take them away, can limit them, while when you have something enshrined in the Constitution, in our constitutional rights, which is my understanding of what you just said about rights, then political process cannot do that, that in Trump's political process. So this is my answer. I actually was responsible for Polish Constitution precisely with that issue, with constitutionalization of social and economic rights. And we were in a kind of the very, very difficult situation because for legitimacy reasons, the constitution that was supposed to go to the public referendum could not leave this issue out completely. So you had to put these rights in the constitution and at the same time to take it away. And there are two solutions and of that were developed, one that was Spanish and Portuguese, actually invented in Ireland, Irish constitution of 1936 and then developed by the Indian constitution, which was putting into constitution something called directive principles or principles of public policy, which did not create enforceable rights. And the Czechoslovak solution, probably invented by Hermann Schwarz, who couldn't be here tonight, and that was that you put all these social rights in the constitution, and in one article you made a statement, rights enumerated in this chapter will be protected within limits set by the statute. So you put these things and then leave them back or send them back. This is Grossbrom case. This is what why actually South Africa Constitutional Court ended up with the Grossbrom case, that you put them in the constitution.
I was very curious to your answer to Rick's question. Do you agree with what the South African Constitutional Court did in the Grootboom case?
Yes, I think I agree, because they very clearly, that they defined that there has to be, Grootboom case can be only considered in view of the South African Constitution, which had the right to housing. And the Grootboom case was, what does it mean and what it will mean? And they said there should be policy. There should be policy that will give Ms. Grootboom in the future, not immediately now, or people in that situation, some hopes that they can get housing. If it was put in the Constitution, I think I agree with the judgment. But I do believe that sending very clear message that these rights belong to political process means that they are not Trump's. And I do believe that there are some rights, rights to social security based on the Congress decisions in the United States are nevertheless rights. They are legal rights, but they are not constitutional rights.
And if I can follow up Rick's earlier question, in the South African Constitutional Court cases, there are two other major cases dealing with those kinds of issues. The first was the Subramani case. This was the case of the man who said he needed a kidney transplant, and if he didn't get the kidney transplant, he would die. And in fact, I think it was the day the Constitutional Court handed down the decision denying him the kidney transplant, he died. And then there was the treatment action case, in which the treatment action campaign was challenging President Mbeki's approach to HIV/AIDS and was challenging particularly the health department's refusal to provide nevirapine to pregnant women, which would prevent the transmission of HIV from mother to child. And in that case, the Constitutional Court ruled that nevirapine should be provided to the children. Essentially, the difference in the outcome of those two cases was the South African Constitutional Court said it would be very expensive to give somebody like Subramani the kidney transplant, and the health department has to be able to make other choices provide, let's say, primary care to large numbers of people, whereas in the Treatment Action Campaign case, they said, well, it doesn't cost very much to administer nevirapine, and South Africa has been offered a 5-year supply free of charge, so it's irrational to deny pregnant women nevirapine. So cost effectively became the distinguishing factor. And I'm curious how you would come out on those two other sort of crucial cases in their handling of these issues.
I think that I read Subramani case. It's becoming very technical and legal, which I don't, but nevertheless I will answer. I understand Subramani case interpret differently than you. It was not the choice between the kidney for Mr. Subramani and other needs of the budget or health issues. That was the issue. Will the fact that Mr. Subramani is very old trump the line of people waiting for kidneys? That was basically the case, because they said you cannot go and get this kidney now, because the health department is deciding in what order and who will get kidneys, and there is no enough kidneys for everyone. So you being old, etc., are unfortunately still on the end of the line, and you will not live towards that. And that's how I understand that. It was not choice between expenses for kidney or other health expenses, but will it Trump or not.
I understood it as the health department's decision was rational in the Subramani case, mm-hmm. not rational in the treatment action campaign case.
I would say that I give the Constitutional Court the power to make such adjustment, you know, to the realities and practice, understanding again that this is basically the issue between rights and public policy. And I don't have much problem with these two decisions.
Okay. If I could dissent quickly. Well, it just strikes me. I mean, I understand the argument, and it has much to commend it. It's simple, it's elegant, it's clear. But my concern is that it kind of comes to the conclusion that human rights are things that limit state power and are fine as long as they don't cost the government anything. Because as soon as they cost the government something, then they're interfering with the democratic process. And to come back to your Haiti example, there could well be a compelling argument that a child says, I have a right to K-12 education, which is understood very commonly as an obligation of states to their citizenry, and not just as a constitutional right, but as a human right. And my right to an education trumps the environmental rights, because if it's a choice between mango trees and my education and a lost generation with no education, let's have the education instead of the mango trees. So I could see where compelling arguments could be made on the basis of human rights by individuals who do not want their particular childhood right to education forfeited by a government, however benign and compelling its reasons.
Rather than pursue that argument, which I'm very tempted to do.
But Arye, I think this here simply I have to make a statement that I think that this room is big enough to hold your opinion and my different opinion about that, really.
I agree.
We had this discussion a number of times, and we have some disagreements, which to me are less acute probably than to you, because I do believe that there can be various rights and they can be enforced in different ways, and there are constitutional rights that trump all other considerations. But I believe there are, you never answered to my saying that can be there statutory rights that are not constitutional, that are resulting from the state adopting some policy. There are still rights. People can go to court. They cannot go to constitutional court.
I'm all for statutory efforts to deal with such questions, because statutory efforts are the periodic policies that are made through a democratic process, and statutory policies can be altered from time to time.
But don't they create rights once they are adopted altered? They create rights.
They create rights.
But not constitutional.
but they don't create rights in the permanent sense in which I think we have been talking about rights. They create opportunities for people to take advantage of particular policies that are agreed upon through the democratic process. And I think we have to make public policies in that fashion in order to deal with the immense complexity of the issues that we have to confront, but that we need to put aside certain questions and say, no, these are not susceptible to the democratic process. The American Bill of Rights begins with the words, Congress shall make no law.
We put them
and
to
those five words essentially say that there are some things which are not subject to the democratic process. They are so significant that we put them aside, and you can't touch them in the democratic process. But statutes are a consequence of the democratic process, and can and should be altered from time to time through the democratic process.
There's a chapter on that. It's about the constitutional rights. Constitutional rights are rights that are trumping everything.
I want to take you in a slightly different direction.
Fabulous.
Okay.
Can I get more water from anyone here?
You know, I haven't touched mine, so why don't you...
You don't need one? You can share with me. Okay. I will share your water. This is still not touched.
This is a passage which really startled me when I came to it. It's at page 174, and it says, in short, human rights organizations today pursue many different goals and represent a number of diversified interests. Not surprisingly, they also adopt different strategies. They have to compete for decreasing resources from the West and for limited resources in societies in which they are active. The resulting differentiation has led to diminished hopes for the human rights movement ever reunifying successfully again. It is difficult to define a common set of ideas and values to which a majority of human rights organizations could subscribe. And it's really that last sentence, that it's difficult to define a common set of ideas and values to which a majority of human rights organizations could subscribe, that I found so startling. And my view has been that there is a mainstream set of concerns that characterizes the human rights movement, and that what in fact makes it a successful movement, an effective movement, is that there is that common set of values and common set of ideas. And there are certainly differences at the margins, but the core beliefs of the human rights movement, the belief in freedom of inquiry and expression, the belief in due process of law, the belief in the right not to be tortured or physically abused, in some way, a belief in the right to privacy, I would add, even a belief in the right to take part in self-government, that these are core beliefs and values, and that they are, in fact, shared within the human rights movement worldwide, and that it is an effective movement because of that. And if it doesn't have that core set of beliefs and values, obviously, the right to equal treatment has to be part of that as well. If it doesn't have that, then I don't think it can be effective. I don't think it amounts to much if there is not that common set of beliefs and values. Page 174.
Yeah, I see. Yeah. So, Arya, I concede to you something here now for a change. So what I concede would be that if there is ever, that depends a great deal on John Berger or present here, if there is a second edition, I will change a majority to a great majority, perhaps. But I will still have, I think that you were much more right 10 years ago than today. And I think that something has happened really very important. And I speak now through experience. I want to acknowledge Irena Grudzinska-Gross sitting there when she was human rights person at the Ford Foundation. We did together, she asked me to help with two conferences between East European and African constitutional lawyers and human rights activists and organizations. And I was surprised how much the agendas differ, and how much of the issues that we here think don't belong to human rights, or how much for them social and economic issues and rights were important, and that was for them basically core rights. When we went with Jim Goldstone, who couldn't be here, to Peru after Fujimori Montezino were abolished, kicked out, and talked with people in Lima about rights, about the political change, etc., they talked about basic, this core rights that you talked about. Then we had a meeting with a number of the human rights NGOs in Cusco, in the Andes, and what they were talking about was different. For them it was that, you know, the women are beaten by men, and which is not state, basically state issues, which is criminal issue, but for them that was basic human rights issue, and the fact that young girls are sent to towns for the to work as servants, and for them that was the major core human rights issue. And we got back to Lima and talked with politicians and human rights lawyers about this issue. They were saying this is not a problem, and all of them had these domestic servants, of course, from the Andes. And then you see, when I went to the
If I could just interrupt, if you say women are beaten by men, I consider that a core human rights issue in the following respect, that if the state has a responsibility to protect its citizens, that if the state then excludes women from that protection and denies them equal protection of the laws, that seems to me to violate a core human right. That is, they have a right to equal treatment, that if the state would protect others against beatings, it has to protect women against beatings by men.
Okay, thank you. So I will continue. Then I went to the Philippines for the South and Southeast Asia meeting of human rights and legal empowerment groups. And what they were talking basically was group rights, which we both have very skeptical attitude and reject. But they were human rights organizations. They were talking about indigenous group rights. They were talking about other group rights, which were not 10 years as much in the parlance and in this main language or core set of ideas of right. But for them it's important. Samuel Martinez of the University of Connecticut wrote a fascinating paper. He's writing a book about the different agenda of human rights NGOs in Latin America and actually in Caribbeans, of two types. One of them, who are basically donor-driven NGOs that are representing the I would call the traditional agenda you mentioned, and the local indigenous NGOs that are pursuing different agendas and are basically somehow precisely competing for resources with these others. And I had a number of other experiences of that type, which would tell me, yes, this movement also has diversified very much. And I think that, yes, I say great majority will be in second edition, so keep me on that, you know, remind me that, but not all of them. This something happened. The second thing which happened, I believe that 50, 60 years ago in different shape and 30 years ago for another meaning, there was some consensus about philosophy of human rights. I don't think this consensus can be restored.
No. I'm sorry to hear that you believe that. I think we have about 15 minutes left, and I wonder if we could open this up. Is there a microphone?
I never answered Richard's questions, but I will answer that.
We have a microphone, so if anybody wants to speak, we'll. Okay, over. Do you want to answer the question while we're getting the microphone to him?
No, actually, you know, about globalization, I think that I would write similar thing, because most of the countries that states are back and taller, they still didn't regain capacity to control the economic factors, except for a few most powerful countries. So I think that changed. The states stand taller, but as powerless as they were before. And there are a number of reasons that I didn't deal with international justice, except for the historical period, historical part, because I really went into four basic different debates. And for me, the historical justice or international justice is not a subject of a debate. It's basically agreement about that, or most of the agreement about it.
Okay. Thank you very much. My name is Yunus, and my question is, You were talking about states, and you gave an example of Haiti, for example, and how the prime minister chose or is thinking about choosing planting trees instead of building schools, and the argument on the other side said, no, I choose schools. And I think there was a concept that has been left out of the conversation, which is progressive realization. Can't we say that, for example, by building those trees, this is a progressive step towards ensuring all those rights in the long run? And that's my first comment, and I would like any of you to comment on the progressive realization concept. The other one is, you said that you disagree with expanding rights because that makes them lose value or lose enforcement. And first of all, that assumes that it's only one community working to ensure all rights, which I think is not very valid, because different human rights communities work on different rights in different ways. So, for example, right to development, which you thought was very broad, I think if you talk to someone who's from a poor African country or a poor Latin American country, I think a right to development would be much more important than a lot of rights that in the U.S. or in the West, for example, would seem prime. And so I think there's a little bit of ethnocentrism in that statement.
Okay, look,
so these are two comments I'd like you to comment on.
I think the question should mainly go to Victor rather than to me, but since that's directed to me, I'll answer very briefly. And that is, look, if a particular policy that focuses on dealing with environmental degradation is seen as a way of progressively realizing the right to education, then it seems to me that any government can say, look, our policies, let's say, on capital accumulation are a way of realizing these rights, like the right to education, like the right to health care, and it makes those rights meaningless. And I don't think rights should ever be meaningless. The other question with respect to the right to development, I worry about meaninglessness. And it's meaningless because unless you have a global authority with enforcement powers, which can, let's say, tax the United States at a substantial level, and tax the wealthy countries of Europe at a substantial level, and tax Saudi Arabia and other wealthy countries at a substantial level, and transfer resources to the poor countries, unless you have that kind of global government, how do you enforce a right to development? I think there's no chance that we will get that kind of global government. I'm well along in years, so it won't happen in my lifetime, but it won't happen in the lifetime of the youngest person in this room, and it won't happen in several lifetimes after that. What's the point of calling something a right if in practice it is meaningless? That's my point.
You see, but progressive realization was really one of the, if you read the book by Marianne Glendon or by Morsing about the creation of the Universal Declaration, progressive realization was for many of the drafters crucial thing, which even permitted some kind of consensus in 1948. What I claim in this book is that there are different concepts of human rights in 1948, 1978, and 2008. And the 2008 is just bringing to the 1978 concept some elements that were discarded between 48 and 78, and developing or increasing concept for some things that are important, with which the theory of rights grapples very, with a lot of difficulties, and not convincingly, like the problem how to use rights for the protection of environment, which is basically requires, again, what you said, global government, global policy. But I do believe, for example, that if every person had a right to standing about environmental issue, it would still be very good. If I would have a right to standing, that means to require from the government that government of my country or other country perhaps is collecting and providing me with information about the environmental consequences of any activity, governmental or non-governmental, and then gives me also the standing to start the procedure to ban some activity or to regulate some activity, we would be much better off than we are. So I believe that these concepts are evolving, that, and I have perhaps difficult would be to me to make a case about 2008 versus 78, but 78 and 48, I can really make a case that there are two different concepts. The consensus that was coined at the end of the drafting process was very broad, and progressive realization and the moral value and the future goals and ideals for the humankind was crucial for that. For 78, both for the politics, international politics, especially of the Western countries, and international human rights movement. Now, civil and political rights are becoming crucial and the most important. And the concept is limited compared to this broad consensus of 48. And no wonder that people from not the dictators, but some people, well-meaning people from non-Western countries could say, well, wait a minute, what you brought back, you know, with Human Rights Watch and what you brought back as human rights in 1970s is not what we agreed upon in 1948. It's limited. It's leaving out some things that people agreed. So I believe that you know, the notion is very dynamic and not once and forever. And this that somehow relates to this progressive realization as a concept, original concept in 48.
Okay. Joanna. And
thank you. My name is Joanna Weschler. I'm not sure it's a question, but I wanted to go back to that conversation at the very beginning, which was about whether rights are about morality or enforceability. And just a comment on the Russian or, Soviet or Polish early human rights efforts. I think the fact that those people have referred to the existing law was in fact on their part building a self-defense system and also preempting propaganda, because it took enormous courage to do anything of the sort that they were doing, and they needed to say that this is something that's completely justified under existing laws, which most citizens didn't realize. And I think it's not because their concept of rights was very much grounded in their law. It's just that what they were doing to get to the rights was not an illegal activity under existing law in the regime. But I think, well, you already first talked about enforceability, but then you actually modified your definition of rights as putting limits on power. And if my memory serves me right, in the 1980s up until the early 1990s, the international human rights movement was about putting limits on power, but not about necessarily enforceability, because we would probably not get out of bed if it was something that was necessarily enforceable. Yes, it was enforceable, but only through precisely moral pressure and not through an illegal system, because the talk about legal enforcement of human rights only really became serious when concept of international justice became something more than a concept and it became reality. So is enforceability and putting limits on power the same thing for you, or would you actually make a distinction?
Is it the same thing, or would I make a distinction? What I mean by enforceability is that there should be a possibility of enforceability. There may be many times and places where, in practice, rights are not enforceable. So if I argue for rights in Burma or Turkmenistan or North Korea, there's no possibility in that political circumstance of enforceability. But in effect, what I'm asking for is a system in which, in fact, those rights will be enforceable. I'm trying to achieve that kind of a system. And in that respect, I think placing limits on power and enforceability are the same.
But once you do that, once you achieve that result, I claim that you don't need the notion of human rights. You have a notion of constitutional rights or enforceable rights, and not necessarily human. But I want to also thank Joanna because she contributed very much to my book by reading the manuscript and giving me fabulous, fabulous, really helpful advice and comments. Thank you.
Okay. I saw one other hand. Yes, in back.
And the guy over there. Okay.
My name is Amanda Wetzel, and I'm with the Justice Initiative. And my question concerns, I guess, what the role of human rights in the aftermath of ethnic conflict and the way human rights have been guaranteed in various peace agreements and then implemented as a result of those peace agreements plays into kind of how the concept of human rights has evolved over time. And I think particularly about some experience in Northern Ireland. And in Northern Ireland, there was a peace agreement that gave the Human Rights Commission a mandate to draft a Bill of Rights that fit the particular circumstances of that conflict. And over a period of 10 years, the Human Rights Commission went on to consult widely on a wide variety of topics, including group rights, regarding what should be human rights in the Northern Ireland context. So I was wondering, because there have been many peace agreements that include provisions to expand human rights guarantees in the country that are sometimes imposed on the country and other times left to consultation, how those processes have kind of expanded our understanding of the general concept within the international framework, if that makes sense.
To me, that is another proof that it is extremely flexible notion. Because it is talking about what is desirable, not necessarily what is enforceable now and here today. And of course, the peace agreement can take basic fundamental issues of rights and cut them to the needs and actual circumstances or demands of particular conflict, and they are called still human rights, and they are basically either narrowed down or shaped to solve the problem, because the notion is so. I would say that the most universal thing about human rights, besides some basic content, which I agree with Arya, that and there is even list of such rights that I call that should be universal in this chapter on universality, and I think that we would be in agreement with most of what is in it, but what is the most universal is usefulness of the concept for various either conflicts or various demands or various needs of people whenever they are deprived of an enforced a possibility or they are creating something new as with most of the peace agreements, rules of the game.
Just a very quick addition to that. I first started doing work in Latin America in the mid-80s in Guatemala and El Salvador. And if you look at what human rights organizations were doing then in Latin America around post-conflict justice, it was very rudimentary compared to now. I mean, I think this area has expanded and become, partly through the contribution of OSI, which I know has done a lot of work on this, become much more sophisticated. And Victor has a nice discussion in his book of legal empowerment and questions of access to justice, and not just putting in place the right kind of penal reform, but actually seeking to improve popular access to justice and make rule of law meaningful.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. Garth?
Thank you. My name is Garth Mankes. My question is for Victor. Victor, your description of human rights, or your attempt, your concept of human rights, seems to me to be rooted deeply in your attempt to describe the way that people are using human rights and the way it has historically been applied. But then you, as the title of your book says, you have limits. And these limits suggest that you're in a way making a judgment about how people should or shouldn't be using human rights. And I'm interested in knowing where that limit comes from, if it's not just a description of the way that people are using it, what is informing your judgment about where the limit is? Is it connected with your idea about constitutional rights? Is it that constitutional rights are the real rights, and that it's only rights that can somehow become enforceable constitutional rights that enjoy the limit that you're talking about? What is the basis for the limit? And is it in any way connected with your idea of constitutional rights?
Only partly, and this is related to the second chapter on the rights and democracy, where I put limits on both democracy and on rights. And I think that excess of rights impoverishes democracy and steals resources and from the political process, which is essential for democracy, and also limits the substance or the sphere of political debate and political process. And actually, I see that the moving of politics into the identity areas is one of the results that so many of the conflicts that were traditionally for politics about resources, other things, are already preempted by constitutionalization. So, or either in European Union by the supranational decisions. So the politicians that have to quarrel about something go into this new realms or old realms and find them extremely effective because they can be. It's more difficult to hold them responsible. So I see the limits in various ways. I see the limits of rights in the satisfaction of needs. I'm just very clearly saying that only some needs, some very limited needs of human being or communities can and should be satisfied by the instrumentarium of rights. And what comes to the last chapter, that's basically experience and life experience and looking at others, that I realize that in this important spheres of life, like, you know, the personal relations, like the sense, search of meaning, etc., there are limits not to content of rights, but to usefulness of rights, that we don't go far in, let's say, you know, I bring this to great one greatest, I believe, philosopher of rights, Joel Feinberg, you know, with his concept of the Wernersville II and the limits to rights, and combined him with perhaps not as great philosopher but good scholar Jeremy Waldron, who says that rights are fallback mechanisms. And I do believe that for relationship, let's say love or friendship or other things. That's what basically Joel Feinberg says. Joel Feinberg said in 1971 in the article on nature and limits of rights, imagine place when there is no rights, where let's call it Nowheresville. Okay. And he describes the life in Nowheresville. And I wrote on the margin, it's like Poland under communism. You know? More or less, he really described. And then this article became extremely popular and it was reprinted here and there and there. And in 1978, Mr. and Mrs. Bandman were publishing the collective book on the medical problems, you know, of rights. And they asked Feinberg if they can reprint it. And Feinberg said, yes, but I want a postscript also because I gave some sauce to that. And he said, imagine now a place which is called Nowheresville II, where there are rights and only rights, and everyone has to always enforce and go after their rights. And he says, now this is a community in which there is no room for forgiveness, love, gift, compassion, and things like that. So this is pretty also inhuman. And basically, that's where Waldron comes, who would say rights are necessary fallback mechanisms. It will be much better to have ideal relationship with other people based on trust, feeling, compassion, all these good things. But love is betrayed and abused, etc., etc. And whenever you are abused, you should have rights to fall back on them. And I think that that's where our both limits and necessity of right, because a good benevolent ruler could come and say, I know that rights will not give you happiness and love, so I will take away from you. It doesn't work. I have to have first rights to be able to make self-limitation on those. So that's where how I consider this philosophical or ethical dimension of limits of rights.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. As you can see, it's a provocative book, and I recommend reading it.
Thank you.